Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Nothing reflects the spirit of the 60s better than the Peace Corps. But what were its origins, and exactly how did it relate to the idealism of that decade in the Kennedy administration? That's the subject of our interview this week. But before we get to that, let's look at an important event that occurred this week in history. May 20th may be the most significant day in aviation history, especially in transatlantic aviation history. On May 20th, 1927, Charles Lindbergh took off from Roosevelt Field in Long Island, New York, aboard the Spirit of St. Louis on his historic solo flight to France. Lindbergh, backed by a group of St. Louis businessmen, was competing for a $25,000 prize for the first person to accomplish the feat. In winning the prize, of course, he also became a national hero. On May 20, 1932, another American hero, Amelia Earhart, took off from Newfoundland for Ireland to become the first woman to fly solo across the Atlantic. In 1937, she and her plane vanished over the Pacific during the first leg of her attempted flight around the world. And on May 20, 1939, regular transatlantic air service began as a Pan American Airways plane, the Yankee Clipper, took off from Port Washington, New York, bound for Europe. Pan Am started in 1927, flying mail between Key West, Florida, and Havana, Cuba. Over the course of the next decade, it added other destinations around the world, at one point employing Charles Lindbergh to survey some of those new routes. Turning to an item of historical interest in the news, he has cracked the toughest cases in the United States, probed mass graves in Bosnia, and was a star in the O.J. Simpson trial. Now, Henry Lee has set out to find the grave of a long-dead Indian princess, Pocahontas. The legendary Native American befriended the Jamestown colonists and, according to legend in the Disney film, saved the life of Captain John Smith from death at the hands of her father. Pocahontas was buried in an English graveyard, but her remains had been lost. The part of the story that Disney did not tell is that after supposedly saving Smith's life, Pocahontas converted to Christianity, took the name Rebecca, and married Virginia colonist John Rolfe. In 1616, the Rolfes traveled to England, where they were introduced at court and became the hit of the mother country's highest social circles. Unfortunately, Pocahontas died the next year and was buried in St. George's Church in Gravesend, England. In 1727, the church burned and a new one was built, but not before several graves were opened and the remains reinterred in the church courtyard. There's no record indicating which graves were moved, but Henry Lee has vowed to find Pocahontas's. You're listening to Talking History.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must a white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Isn't how many times must...
It leads such a quiet existence today that few Americans even realize that it still exists. They recall the Peace Corps as a product of the 1960s and the peace, love, and give-a-damn generation. Well, it does still exist, and the Peace Corps has an interesting history that spans the decades, as Talking History's Eileen Dugan discovered in her conversation with Elizabeth Cobbs Hoffman.
Founded in the early days of the Kennedy administration, the Peace Corps has proven to be one of the most enduring and popular symbols of 1960s American idealism. The image of thousands of American young people living in third world countries, enduring hardships, teaching, and helping to build communities, fired the imagination and made Americans hope that the United States' status as superpower did indeed have a humanitarian aspect to balance the political. With us today to trace the origins of the Peace Corps is Dr. Elizabeth Cobbs Hoffman, Dwight E. Stanford Professor of American Foreign Relations at San Diego State University. Dr. Cobbs Hoffman is the author of the recent monograph, All You Need Is Love, The Peace Corps in the Spirit of the 1960s. Welcome, Dr. Cobbs Hoffman.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dugan.
We all tend to associate the Peace Corps with JFK, but not many are sure just how it came into being. How did the idea of the Peace Corps begin with JFK, or did it actually predate his presidency?
Well, really, I think in many ways, JFK kind of tripped over the idea of the Peace Corps. It was an idea that deeply appealed to him, but it was something that was in the air. And many people feel this is what really made JFK such a charismatic and interesting president, is that he was a person who managed to tap into what was the spirit that that was really there in a lot of people. And actually some U.S. Politicians like Hubert Humphrey, for example, had an idea very similar, you know, well before JFK. And so, but it was just really one of those things that was out there, and that was out there not only in the United States, but this was fascinating to me when I did my research, because I was totally unaware that there were really prototypes and predecessors of the Peace Corps in other countries, like Britain and Australia and Canada. And the weird thing is it's not that they all learned from one another, but that they all had the idea around the same time. And in fact, the United States and Canada sent volunteers in the same month, but were really unaware of each other's efforts when they first got going.
You mentioned that the Peace Corps tapped into the spirit of the 1960s. How so?
Well, I think that the 60s was really a world phenomenon that, that again, explains its popularity, why everyone seemed to experience some of the same things they did at the same time. And a lot of it had to do with this sense of people struggling for a way to change the world as individuals, to escape the kind of feeling that they were cogs in a giant machine, the machine that the world had become after World War II and that mass industrialization had created. So this spirit, I think, in many ways is elusive but was very powerful. I called my book All You Need Is Love, partly because I think that for many people in this generation, this notion that love is power, which I know sounds really hokey today, but at the time, this was an idea that reverberated not only in music, but throughout politics and in organizations like the Peace Corps.
And this also fits in with JFK's idea of the new frontier. Isn't that right?
Oh, absolutely. This, the frontier itself, you immediately conjure up images of men and women striking out into the cold, brutal loneliness of the Western frontier, and being individuals, doing something that arises out of their courage and their spirit of adventure, which very much fits. And I think it's not at all coincidental that when he called it his programs the New Frontier, what he was really saying was this was a way for Americans to be their best selves, who they had been historically. Now, whether or not we'd really been that historically, of course, is the kind of thing that historians debate, but I think that Americans believed it when he said it.
And how did the Peace Corps also tie in with American foreign policy at the time?
Well, that's a curious thing, because, I think people tend to avoid thinking of it as a foreign policy maneuver, but it really was, and that's partly because we tend to think of maneuvers as being cynical, kinds of things, and everyone wants to think of the Peace Corps as purely idealistic, but I think it's always been the case that idealism blends with more practical considerations in America. That's always true. In this case, I think part of what we had going on is that in our great conflict with the Soviet Union, one of the elements of that conflict was that the Soviets were always able to sort of point to us and say, well, look how hypocritical America is, out there in the rest of the world. Here they're hosing African Americans off the sidewalks in Birmingham, Alabama. And yet they're telling you out there in Africa, we're your friends. So how can we be your friends? How can they rather be your friends? So the Peace Corps was a very conscious way of trying to show the rest of the world, especially the Third World, which is where the Cold War was hot in places like Vietnam, that America, could be was something other than what the Soviets were portraying us as.
And how did the Peace Corps actually come into being? Was it something established by Congress or what?
No, actually, it did get established by Congress in September of 1961. But JFK, this was very consistent with his personality. Again, one of the reasons why his personality is so often debated. He struck out quite early on his own. His brother-in-law, Sergeant Shriver, was the first director of the Peace Corps. And Shriver had suggested to John Kennedy that he establish the Peace Corps by executive order, a kind of a damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead approach. And Kennedy did it in March 1st of 1961, so, about a month and a half after his inauguration. And then came along and asked Congress to, formally establish the agency with congressional money and all of that. But initially, it got started by the executive.
So was it very easy to get the support for the Peace Corps, or were those who were critical of the idea?
Well, it was a funny thing. It's so quintessentially American. In some ways, it seems like, especially in retrospect, it's kind of like motherhood and apple pie or something. You know, how could anybody oppose the Peace Corps? But there were people at the time who saw it as being, well, either frivolous and kind of silly. Why would you send these kiddies out? And in fact, some people said, oh, it's going to be like a kiddie corps. But then there were others who viewed it a little bit more, you know, greater, in fact, suspicion. The Daughters of the American Revolution passed an overwhelming resolution to, condemn the Peace Corps as an example of how it would make young Americans into socialists, because they would send these poor, naive young Americans out there in the big bad world, and the communists would corrupt them and this kind of thing. And so it's sort of funny, they took this great vote to send off to President Kennedy, advising him not to start the Peace Corps, and the vote was 2,600-1. I don't know who that one person was, but she must have been very, very brave or very idiosyncratic.
Yes, very much so. What were the initial challenges of putting so many young volunteers into the field? And did they all do the same thing, or did it vary according to region?
It varied a lot. The challenge, of course, was partly, they were sending out all of these volunteers and saying to these countries, hey, how would you like some young Americans come help you? And that seemed very bizarre initially to a lot of countries, and they thought, oh my gosh, what they're doing is they're sending spies. You know, this is just a very clever new way of getting American influence out there. And so initially there was a fair amount of suspicion, and this is where Sergeant Shriver was quite clever and adept. He decided, after sort of sitting back and waiting for a while and not seeing any invitations come in, inviting these young Americans who were being offered, he decided to go out himself and kind of put a human face, his face, the face of John Kennedy's brother-in-law, on the program. And he went on this great whirlwind trip around the world and met with those people in the Third World who were most prestigious and also most suspicious of the Peace Corps. And he really, he convinced them. He charmed them. So they did get invitations, and they sent people out, but one of the great problems is a lot of these countries couldn't figure out what in the heck they were going to do with these young Americans, and so it took a while to really find real jobs for them. And there are a lot of young people who, suffered through a few summers in a swamp out there or on the top of a mountain and really did not know what to do for quite a period of time.
And who actually joined the Peace Corps, and how racially diverse was the Peace Corps in its beginnings?
Well, the Peace Corps, attracted a broad range of Americans in the sense of, especially geographically, people from all over the country, from tiny little towns, from big cities, Protestant volunteers, Catholic volunteers, Jewish volunteers. So in that sense, it was diverse. It did not have a lot of racial diversity, although it was, more than most organizations, probably especially in that period of time, it was very committed to this notion, which seems, a very modern one now, but wasn't very common then. It was committed to the notion of racial diversity. And this, again, was going back to its Cold War objectives. It wanted to show that America was committed to racial equality, that, that we, were living by our ideals. And so one of the things they did is that when they did have African Americans in particular who, wanted to work with the Peace Corps, they tended to put them in pretty prominent spots and this kind of thing, made them country directors in some cases, and really, fine people who did good work. But it was tough. They, they had this ideal, but it was hard a lot of the time to live up to.
And how were they trained?
Oh, in all kinds of strange ways. They brought an Outward Bound, which was originally kind of a British initiative, to toughen up these young people. They had this pioneer notion, this new frontier. For the silliest perhaps of all, they had this one training program where they would bind the people and throw them into a pool. It's sort of like Harry Houdini. They had to figure out how to get untied and swim. I mean, as if this is what was going to happen to you when you went to Africa or Asia or Latin America or something. And of course, nothing like that happened, but they wanted to develop this, kind of mythical Paul Bunyan-like resilience. Now, a lot of this was the early 60s, and it changed as time went on. And And really the focus of training especially was on languages, because this was a period of time in which more than half of all of the people who worked for the U.S. State Department could not speak one foreign language. And there was this, you know, belief and this, you know, realization that Americans were not doing very well communicating with the rest of the world if, you know, if all they could speak was English. And if every time they went to a foreign country, they insisted, well, gee, you know, why don't you speak my language? What's wrong with you? Rather than understanding that what was wrong with us is that we weren't trying hard enough. So they spent a lot of time teaching volunteers how to speak a variety of languages.
And throwing them into pools bound hand and foot.
Hand and foot, right. Having them scale mountains and swing on ropes in Puerto Rico and, you know, generally play Tarzan. And, you know, it is funny in retrospect. And then, of course, that's always what makes history interesting, is to get into the worldview of another time and you say, my gosh, how could they, you know, how could they have thought and felt this way? And yet they did.
Now, what impact did the Vietnam War have upon the Peace Corps?
Well, the war, you know, as we know, devastated American idealism and turned it inside out to a great cynicism, and went, you know, did a lot of damage to Americans' notions of what their country was about, and something from which we haven't yet fully recuperated, I think. What the war did specifically to the Peace Corps was that it immediately sapped the numbers of people who wanted to go into the Peace Corps. People volunteering went way down by the late 60s, and not surprisingly, the number of young men went way up. There had been a relatively equal sex balance within the Peace Corps volunteers, but by the early 70s, it was something like 70% males, which of course meant that these were a lot of young guys trying to avoid the draft by serving in some other branch of the U.S. government. Although, you know, they could be drafted out of Peace Corps, and in fact, there were people, and I talk about this in my book, who were, you know, plucked out of, you know, Togo or, you know, some part of, remote part of Asia and sent to Vietnam.
And how did the Peace Corps evolve in the course of the 70s, 80s, and 90s?
Well, I think, interestingly, it went through some more ups and downs in the 70s. When Jimmy Carter came into office, there was a sense of, my gosh, we have to return it to the idealism of the Kennedy era. And there was an attempt to sort of remake the identity of the Peace Corps. But interestingly, what really happens is that the Peace Corps becomes such a piece of Americana that it endures. And it manages, because it's always being passed back and forth between Republican and Democratic presidents, it manages to fit itself into a broad consensus of American life. And then what happens in the Reagan era is that David Stockman, some listeners will probably remember, was the budget director for Ronald Reagan and came in with a very large hatchet ready to, you know, chop up anything that smacked of the Great Society or the Kennedy era, and was all prepared to, you know, take apart the Peace Corps, you know, bit by bit. And the Republican appointee for the Peace Corps, who had been brought in to direct it, came into Reagan presidency and, you know, basically said, well, you know, I'm here to make sure this thing doesn't die, a woman named Laura Rupe. And she really rejuvenated the Peace Corps. Its numbers have continued to grow. The low point was the 80s, but today it's above 7,000 volunteers. So it's really, it continues to do a lot of good work.
Yeah, that's actually my final question. We only have a moment, but what purpose does the Peace Corps have in the 21st century?
You know, I think ironically what the Peace Corps mostly does is it makes Americans feel American. They look at the Peace Corps and they think, you know, this is something we can do that bespeaks the values that make America what it is. There are very few countries which are as ideologically determined in some ways as the United States. We think of democracy as being the sine qua non of the United States. How can you have a United States and have it not be a democratic government that grew out of certain ideals? And it's a selfish sort of thing, but I think the Peace Corps does a lot for the United States. It also does a fair amount for foreign countries in the sense of helping other countries feel a presence of the United States, which is a beneficial presence, and rather than not just this, you know, giant world power out to police people and make them behave. You know, I was in Africa doing research for the book, and one of the most moving comments I heard was by a fellow who was a former ambassador to Switzerland and everything, and he said, it is a morale booster when you have volunteers from the greatest power on earth coming here, helping you, not what they are doing, but to give you hope. You feel that you are a part. You belong to a world. You are not unimportant or neglected. And I think that for many countries, they feel that they're not on the map of the world. They're not on the mental map of the wealthy and the powerful. And the Peace Corps shows them that somebody here does see them. And I think that that's a very powerful contribution to foreign relations.
Well, thank you very much. We have been talking with Dr. Elizabeth Cobbs-Hoffman, Dwight E. Stanford Professor of American Foreign Relations at San Diego State University and author of All You Need Is Love, The Peace Corps, and the Spirit of the 1960s.
All you need is love. All you need is love.
Continuing on the subject of the Peace Corps, we're pleased to welcome to Talking History the current Peace Corps Director, Mark Schneider. Director Schneider gives us his views of the history, accomplishments, and legacy of the Peace Corps, as well as its plans for the future.
I served as a Peace Corps volunteer in El Salvador, along with my wife Susan, from 1966 to 1968. The Peace Corps has a long history with Creighton University. Since 1961, almost 100 Creighton University graduates have served in the Peace Corps. In over four decades, about 1,300 Nebraskans have joined the Peace Corps. Currently, nearly 7,000 Peace Corps volunteers are working in 77 countries to bring clean water to communities, to teach children, to protect the environment, to help start new businesses, and to prevent the spread of AIDS. Since 1961, more than 155,000 Americans have joined the Peace Corps, serving in 134 countries. Over the last 39 years, our volunteers have strengthened the ties of friendship and international understanding between Americans and the people of other countries. Last month, I announced a new initiative that will expand the role the Peace Corps volunteers play in bringing the power of information technology to the task of poverty reduction. Most of our currently serving volunteers are comparative experts in information technology, and many of them already are pioneering computer access in some of the poorest communities in the world. We are giving volunteers the green light to innovate in bridging the digital divide while remaining true to the core mission that President Kennedy set out for the Peace Corps, to help the people of the world help themselves. I also hope to expand the Peace Corps efforts to raise awareness in the fight against HIV/AIDS and to contribute to other international efforts to eradicate polio. The spread of AIDS is inflicting a terrible and devastating toll on millions of innocent people and preventing many countries from consolidating their gains in economic and social development. There is no greater humanitarian crisis in the world today. There is no greater development obstacle. Our volunteers can and should be empowering communities through education to prevent the spread of AIDS. The Peace Corps is alive and well and keeping faith with its legacy. That is why it remains one of the most effective, best known, and widely accepted international volunteer organizations in the world. This is an exciting time to be a part of the Peace Corps. I'm thrilled to be its director, and I'm delighted to share my thoughts for the future of the Peace Corps with you all today.
You've been listening to Mark Schneider, director of the Peace Corps, and this is Talking History.
In the chilly of night, of uncertainty, I want to be in the warm hold of your loving mind. To feel you all around me and take your hand.
They've been available to the public since 1947, but reading them meant traveling long distances to various locations to read the originals, or visiting a major research library and cranking through miles of microfilm on mechanical projectors. Now those of you with internet access can read Abraham Lincoln's mail from your own home. Here to tell you how and where in our historic site of the week is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The Library of Congress has made Abraham Lincoln's mail available on its website. Many of the letters are from political supporters, including several during the time of the Lincoln-Douglas debates of 1858. Although most of the papers consist of letters written to Lincoln, there are treasures written by the President himself, including a first draft of the Emancipation Proclamation, a first draft and reading copy of the Gettysburg Address, along with a memo expressing his belief he would lose the 1864 presidential election. While the Lincoln file has been available since 1947 on microfilm, this makes the letters available to anyone with Internet access. If you would like to read the transcripts of the handwritten letters, just visit the Library of Congress website and do a search for Abraham Lincoln Papers.
And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions. If you plan to be in Washington, D.C. soon, we recommend that you visit the Smithsonian's Arts and Industries Building to see Reflections in Black, a history of black photographers from 1840 to the present. The exhibit, which runs through July 30th, includes 120 images by leading African-American photographers documenting the black experience from slavery to the emergence of the African-American middle class. And while you're there, take a look at the exhibit, Speak to My Heart, Communities of Faith, and Contemporary African-American Life, which runs for the rest of the year. Speak to My Heart uses photographs, music, and other documents to represent the role of the black church in African-American history. Be sure to call the Smithsonian's Arts and Industries Building for further information. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we'll take a look at the history of pets. Until then, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Isn't how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yes, and how many years can a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? Yes, and how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? Yes, and how many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yes, and how many times must a man look up before he can see the sky? Yes, and how many ears must one man have before he can hear?